So wonderful to see people in person. Jeffrey is just making some photocopies for us, hopefully, so that we all have sheets in front of us. I forgot that when we're in person, I make photocopies. So please God, I'll be more prepared next week. But it has been, in all fairness, a year and three quarters, 3 year and a half since we've been in person. So I'm a little out of shape, but it's so great to have people in actual person and not just staring at a computer screen. And please God, it should only continue that we'll be able to learn in person. And as people continue to feel more comfortable, those of you who are online, you're welcome to join us whenever you're in Boca, if you are in Boca, as you feel comfortable. And there's coffee in the back, and maybe we'll introduce more delicacies as this season comes along. Hello, how are you? Yeah, if you don't mind, thank you. All right, so here's the sheets. We are studying this morning chapter 64 of Tehillim as we continue our march through Tehillim. And, you know, it's funny, I was talking to a colleague in New Jersey. He said, how have you not finished the book of Tehillim yet? He goes, I feel like you're creating new chapters of Tehillim. I said, no, it's 150 chapters. It's very long, Tehillim. So even if you do one a week, it's 3 years. And, you know, we obviously have some weeks off along the way. So it is definitely a journey, but it is a journey that has enriched me enormously, and I hope for you as well. And I think we have to work on this setup a little bit, but we will in future weeks. And again, I just want to say it's so great to see everyone in person. Thank you. And please God, it should continue to grow. So again, we're on chapter 64 of Tehillim. Chapter 64 of Tehillim is broken up about into five parts, although I could argue whether it's four parts or five parts. Number one is Psukim 2 through 3, which is an appeal to David HaMelech to protect him from wicked people. Psukim 4 through 7 is David describing the evil deeds of the wicked people. And again, we'll see exactly what that is. 8 through 9 is the downfall of the wicked. And then I'll break it up into four parts. 10 and 11 is really when this downfall of the wicked, the aggrandizement of Hashem, and the righteous rejoicing at the salvation of Hashem. And again, you'll see more clearly what it is exactly that I'm talking about as we continue to study. What I'm going to do today is read through the chapter, give us a little bit of a feel for the chapter, and then I want to share with you two different ways that the commentaries understand this chapter of Tehillim, because you will notice that they understand them in two dramatically different ways. Each way has a beautiful lesson in and of itself. One is, I would say, much more classic to the way that we've been studying Tehillim in the past. You'll say, okay, I know that name. We've had chapters like that before. And one of them, you'll say, where did David HaMelech get this from? And that's ultimately what you and I are going to have to figure out, is why David HaMelech may, according to many of the Mefarshim, have chosen this as a topic to have spoken about. So let's jump right in. And again, I did your sheets quickly, so if there's a mistake, blame Jeffrey. Lam natseach mizmor le David. Again, that's a classic introduction to our chapters of Tehillim. Shema Elohim koli b'sichi mipachad oyev titzor chayai. David HaMelech starts off by saying, Shema Hashem, that Hashem should hear my voice, mipachad oyev titzor chayai, that from the fear of my enemies, you should guard my life. Now again, we don't know what the enemies are, we don't know what they're doing, but clearly, right off the bat, you get the sense that something is happening in David HaMelech's life, that there's a threat to him. We have to figure out exactly what that threat is. I do want to interject that I saw this sefer that I oftentimes quote, which is Chassidus Explanations of Tehillim. So I didn't even realize this when I read the chapter of Tehillim the first time. Maybe you did, but there's a redundancy in this parak, in this pasuk. What's the redundancy? Shema Elohim, listen, so now I can ask questions and you can answer. Isn't that the best part? I've been waiting for that, right? Koli b'sichi. What's koli b'sichi? My voice and my conversation. What's the difference in a voice and a conversation? So you could have very easily just had one without the other. You could have said, Shema Elohim koli mipachad, right? Hear my voice. Or Shema Elohim sichi, hear my conversation. What is the difference between the two of those? Why do you need both of them? So I didn't realize that, but I saw here that almost every commentary that he quotes has some variation of that question. Why do you need both koli and sichi? And I want to share with you one of them, which I think is absolutely beautiful. He doesn't quote it from anyone. So I'll just say it's written in the Chassidish Sfarim, but it's really beautiful. That there are times when davening comes very natural to us. And I know I experienced this in my own personal life as well. There are times when davening comes very naturally to me. Right? Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Aseret Yemei Tshuva, chagim, right? When you come into shul and davening is easy and you're sitting in the siddur, I always say the siddur is like a television. Sometimes it's like HD, high definition color. Sometimes it's black and white. Sometimes, you remember in the old days when you had to like move the, I know, my old days, but, right? When you had to like maneuver, what was that thing called? The antenna, right? You had to like move the antenna, and if you got in the right direction, it was like clear for a second, but then if it like moved, then it went all blurry again. So I find that way with like davening sometimes also. Sometimes you come in a shul, and it's like high definition, full color, HD, everything is working, you feel God's presence, you feel very close, the conversation flows. And then there are times when it's a little bit like black and white. It's a little bit harder, you can definitely make out the image, you understand, you're standing before God, but it doesn't feel as alive as it sometimes does. And sometimes it feels like those, like when you're moving the antenna and you can't get a very good screen. That's how davening feels, for me at least. That's an analogy I use. So for example, when I was in North Carolina this summer, and we were davening out on our porch overlooking the mountains, and there wasn't a human being as far as the eye could see, it was HD, it was high definition color. And I was reading Psukim in Tehillim, in Psukah Dezimra, in parts I never fully appreciated. Like when you get to the part of Ha'arim V'Hagvaot, that the mountains are going to sing praise to God, and you're looking at the mountains, it just like pops for you. So there are moments like that, and then there are moments where it's a little bit less easy to relate to davening. So what this Sefer says is koli, my voice, is a reference to davening. That's when I actually daven to Hashem, right? That's when davening works for me. But then there are times where it's hard to daven. Sometimes you can't make it to shul. Sometimes even when you're able to sit with your sitter in your house, you feel a little bit disconnected. Hashem might feel a little bit more distanced for you. He says that's the word sichi. Sichi means that we're saying to Hashem is that there are two ways that I interact with you. One is through koli, one is through my actual davening, and the other is my sichi. Is when the sitter's not popping for me, when the sitter's not coming alive for me, Hashem, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to sit and I'm going to talk to you. Sichi. See, right, we're speaking now. In the same way I speak to you, thank God, to a human being, so I speak to Hashem. And sometimes that manifests itself in the way of a sitter. And sometimes it manifests itself when I'm taking a walk by myself, or in my case, I'm taking a run by myself, or I'm driving in a car, right? And I stop at a red light, and I talk to Hashem. So what the Sefer says, he says that sometimes it's koli, and sometimes it's sichi. Sometimes it's my actual formal davening, and sometimes it's my sichi. Sometimes it's when I'm not able to formally daven because it's not connecting with me, the sitter's not coming alive for me. And then I'm just going to stop and I'm going to talk to you, Hashem. I'm going to have a conversation with you, Hashem. I thought that was a beautiful understanding of that redundancy. So Shema Elokim Koli B'Sichi, David HaMelech says, Hashem, you should hear my voice. Mipachad Oyev Titzar Chayai. You should guard me from the evil of my enemies. Tastireini Misod Mereim. Tastireini, of course, means to hide. So you should hide me from the Misod Mereim. So here again, you have a little bit of a differentiation in how you understand it. Misod, most understand as a gathering, right? Eitza Hanaseth. So I'm going to get to that, right? But sod, what we really mean, right, when we talk about sod, is a secret. What David HaMelech is clearly saying is that it's both, that they're gathering in secret. In other words, they're not doing so, they're not overtly attacking me, but they're secretly attacking me. The Mitzvah Sion says, Eitza Hanase Bisod. It's something that they're doing in private. The Malbim says, Masha Macharishim Alai Sod Biseser. They're doing it surreptitiously. They're doing it in a very secretive way. Mirikshat Poale Aven. They are agitating me, these evildoers. I don't know what translation you have there, but Mirikshat means like Inyan Hekibutz Kemo Rikshu Agoyim. In other words, they're agitating me, they're annoying me, I don't have a better translation for that, but it's some form of agitation, okay? So, again, we don't know what exactly is going on here. We just know that something's happening in private. We know that they're agitating David HaMelech, okay? Asher shananu kecherev l'shonam. They are sharpening their tongues like a sword. Darchu chitzam davar mar. And they're aiming their arrows with nefarious intentions. Now, off the bat, you'll notice that there are two imageries used here. So oftentimes, when we have two different imageries, the Mefarshim will say, it's just for reinforcement purposes. But we know it's much more complicated than that. What's the difference between an arrow and a sword?
Close and far.
Close and far, right? Sharp. What's another difference between an arrow? Which one's sharper? I don't know, I've never been hit with either one, so. Gigi apparently has. Which one's sharper? No, so near and far, but what does that afford you? Right?
Correct.
So if I'm using a sword, I'm right in front of your face. I have to come right up to you. If I'm shooting an arrow, I could be hiding. I could be far away. You might not even know it's coming. Right? All of a sudden, a sword, I know it's coming. An arrow comes out of nowhere. And so he's clearly on purpose using these two imageries, that they're sharpening their tongue like a sword and they're aiming their arrows. So again, you have both of those components. Malbim points out that notion of mikarov in merachok, near and far. What else do you glean from pasuk number three, which I realize you don't have number there because I was not used to printing you sheets. But what do you notice immediately also? Again, it's the first inkling we get as to what's bothering David HaMelech. All we knew is that they're enemies and that he's davening to Hashem. What are they coming at David with? It's not a... What? Slander, exactly, right? They're using their tongues. They're speaking slanders against David HaMelech. And again, we'll have to see what the context of that is. Liros bamistarim tam. They are preparing in hiding, right? They're shooting in secret. Tam, what does the word tam mean? Right, what does that mean? Simple. Ish tam, yoshevo alim, noach, ish tam. That means a little bit more than simple. It means innocent, right? I'm pure and innocent. So whoever is talking here, we'll assume David HaMelech right now, he's saying that they're shooting in secret to a tam, to someone who's completely innocent. Pitom, yoru velo yiro. What's pitom? Suddenly. Like out of nowhere it's going to come. Again, that imagery of the arrow, where you don't know what's coming until it's like right in your face. What do we say in our mirrors? Like options, you know, objects appear closer, or maybe closer than they appear. Right? So all of a sudden, pitom, it comes suddenly. Velo yira'u. This is important. What's velo yira'u? They're not afraid. Who are they not afraid of? Of God, of David, of consequences. In other words, they think that they can operate completely without any consequences whatsoever. Yichazku lama. They arm themselves, davara, with evil intentions. Yisapru, litmon, mokshim. They plant traps with their tongues. Amru, miyire lamo. And they say to themselves, who is going to stop us? Who is going to bother us? Yachpesu olos tamnu chefes, chefes michupas, v'kerev ish v'leiv amok. There's no really, I tried translating the words, but it was clumsy. So instead I'm going to read for you Rav Hirsch what he says about this pasuk. He says, it is possible to detect and investigate overt acts of criminality. You steal from me, I know about it, I can investigate that act. But the slanderous word that has set the snare is long since said and gone from the minds of men when the crime incited has been committed and is about to be investigated. So let's say I speak negatively about Penny Perlman. She's my neighbor. And she and Bob have parties late until the night. So let's say, right? So let's say I say something not nice. And then Penny comes to me and says, how could you say something not nice about? I don't know what you're talking about. But I heard you said something. I said, do you have proof? Right? Do you have the recording? Right? This was before recordings. You couldn't go back to it. So what Reverse says is, if someone comes and attacks me overtly, okay, now I can investigate it. There are consequences, right? There might be evidence, but the spoken word, what do they think? They think it's here 1 second, gone the next, that I can speak with complete impunity about other people, says Rav Hirsch. An act that is perpetrated leaves some trace, but the spoken word once uttered is gone beyond recall. We assume that I can say things and there are no consequences to what I say about other people whatsoever. And even if he who had originally uttered the word should be found out, let's say Penny finds out that I said something not nice about her, he could readily prove that his remarks have been quite innocent. Who then would be able to detect his evil intention when he makes such speech, such a crime? In other words, you have no clue. There's no accountability. And so for David's saying that people think they could speak about him and that there's no accountability, that they could plead with complete impunity. There's no consequences whatsoever. Now, we, of course, know, in our day and age, it's a little bit different. We have recordings. We have, right, someone's always listening. Alexa, Google, right, your Apple, someone's always listening to every, spoiler alert, they're always listening to us, right? But back then, they didn't have that. So David says, you think that there's no consequence to the way that we speak. And by the way, we do have this nowadays, right? People speak in a way that they don't think has consequence. They put things on the internet, right? Think about social media. One of the challenges of social media is that people assume that they can do so anonymously. That if you're not facing another person, it's much easier to speak harshly about them because you don't have the consequences. After all, you don't know who I am. You're not going to come and confront me about it. So again, there are no consequences to the way that I speak. I was actually thinking about that this week because we were in New Orleans earlier this week, and which I wrote about in the weekly. So one of the individuals that we were helping in his house, we'll call him Mr. W. His name is Eugene. And I asked him about racism in his area. It's a predominantly African-American area. But I said, have you been privy? Have you witnessed any racism? He goes, Rabbi. He goes, I was born here, lived here my whole life. No racism. I said, no racism. I said, that's amazing. What's going on in this country? The political divide, divisive. I said, it's amazing that you claim that you all get along and it's harmonious. He said, yeah. He said, because around here, everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everyone. In other words, if I have a relationship with you, I can't hate you. If you're my neighbor, we might disagree, but at the end of the day, we reckon, like, it's hard to hate someone that you're breaking bread with. It's hard to hate someone who, when a hurricane hits, you guys are all hunkering down together. Right? It's easy to hate someone on social media because there's no accountability for my bashing you or my saying a snide, cynical, sarcastic comment against you. But when I'm face to face with you, it's a lot harder. Part of the challenge in our country is exactly that, is that the political divide is so significant, and Facebook and has exacerbated this issue, is that we all go into our silos. And when I go into my silo, I could speak about the other because it's the other. But if a guy is sitting at my Shabbos table, it's a lot harder to get in a, to really speak negatively about that person. So David is saying that same thing here. He goes, we think that there are no consequences to the words that we speak. We think it's different. A physical act, I would never harm anyone physically. But speaking negatively about a person, it's not as bad. Right? It's not as bad. So that's Pasuk 7 in the way that Rav Hirsch understands it. That there's a lack of consequence to the words that I speak. So that's, up until now, is David describing the evil deeds of the wicked. Pasuk 8 is now when God comes into the picture. Because what you'll notice about up until now is, what did the people think they could do? They said, we can act the way that we act, and then there are going to be no consequences for it. There's no accountability for it whatsoever. Vayorem Elohim chetz pitom. Suddenly, when they least expect it, completely coming out of the blue, and the 11th hour, what's going to happen? Hashem is going to send an arrow. Hayu makosam, and it's going to come and it's going to get them. It's going to beat them back. Vayachshiluhu alemo lishonam yisnodedu kol roe bam. And what's going to happen? Right, their own tongues are going to be their stumbling blocks. In other words, they are going to be their own downfall. Yisnodedu kol roe bam li nodeid. We had this in Parshas Bereishis. Nod vinod. What does that mean? So it means to wander, but here it means that they're going to like shake their head back and forth. You know, like when you see some, like a Nebuch situation, you go, "Ay, so Nebuch." So that's what people are going to see, these individuals who spoke negatively against David HaMelech, and they're going to see their downfall, and they're going, "I wish they had known sooner. I wish they had gotten out of their own way." Vayir'u kol Adam, vayagidu kol poal Elohim. And everyone is going to see this. And they're going to declare, they're going to say that it's the work of Hashem. Umaseyu hiskilu. And they'll all recognize that it is from Hashem. Yismach tzadik ba'adonai. The righteous person is going to rejoice in God. V'chasa bo, is going to trust in God. V'yishalalu kol yishrei lev. And everyone who is upright is going to praise Hashem. That is the chapter of Tehillim. If you had to summarize the chapter of Tehillim, how would you summarize it? Those who are in person. Give me the emotion, right? Let's start with that. Whenever we read Tehillim, we always say it's poetry. Right? So David HaMelech is not just writing it for a specific circumstance, which we'll get to, but it's a lesson for the ages. So I'm curious. We just read it. We read through it. What's the emotional connection to it? What type of circumstance is David HaMelech speaking about? Anybody? Crickets. See, now you're all wishing you had stayed online. You know, no one wants to get called on. So I'll tell you, when I read this, right, it was a little bit not relatable. I mean, definitely as a rabbi, we have circumstances like this. When you know people are speaking about you, when you know that you're the subject of conversation at the Shabbos table, you know, someone told me the other week, they said, one of your articles really caused a lot of ruffles. So I was like, okay, that was the point. But still, right, you wanted to get people's attention. But still, right, it's a little bit unnerving to know that it agitated people a little bit, that people spoke at a Shabbos table about you. So David HaMelech was the king. He was large and in charge. People were out to get him. And one of the ways they went out to get him was using speech. And what David HaMelech is reinforcing for us is that even when it feels like such a precarious situation, even when it feels like our enemies have the upper hand and they're being successful, always have the emunah, pasuchet, right? Always have the emunah that pitom, Hashem is going to come out of nowhere in the 11th hour. And the tzaddik is going to be unscathed. It's going to all be a big kiddush Hashem. Everyone's going to see the salvation of the tzaddik, and they're going to recognize God's hand. Okay, right? Partially relevant, partially not relevant. Let me share with you two vastly different ways of understanding this parakatilla. Number one, I think, is the more classic way. And it's found in the Malbim. It's found in the Radak. I'll read you from the Malbim just because it's a little bit easier. Amru keneged doeg ha-domi vireav. Says the Malbim, this is talking about doeg ha-domi. It's not the first time we've seen doeg in our study of Tehillim. It's probably our fourth or fifth time. If you remember, doeg was a big Talmud Chacham. He was an advisor to David HaMelech, and he ultimately turned on David HaMelech. He was the one who was involved in Nov Ir HaKohanim with the massacre over there. He ratted David out over there, right? So doeg, who is David's trusted advisor, who turned on him, and who spoke slander against him, asher charshu alav ra'a, v'nokshu b'pach asher yichinu lo, and he tried to ensnare David through Doeg telling Shaul about David and trying to get David killed. That is how the Malbim understands it. That is how the Radak understands it as well. And I think if I had polled most of us, if we were not scared to speak out, most of us would have understood it that way, right? So the Radak says, Zeh Shaul Shemavakesh Nafshi, when it talks about Mipachad Oyev, the fear of my enemies, says the Radak, that's talking about Shaul. And that's kind of like the classic way, whenever you're learning Tehillim, right? The default is that when David's talking about enemies, he's talking about none other than Shaul. Shaul's trying to kill him. And it was for a very specific time and place to broaden the theme, if that's the idea. So it's really a lesson about speech. It's a lesson about the power of speech. It's a lesson about how destructive speech can be, right? Again, all lessons which I think are critically important for us nowadays. We had a fascinating conversation at my Shabbos table, at my dinner table last night, which I will not repeat for you here. But let's just say a what? No, I won't repeat all of it because I myself don't want to contribute to it, but somehow a famous talk show radio podcast individual came up at our dinner table last night, and it ended up being a fascinating conversation about the content and the type of speech that is used on some of these podcasts, because I was telling my children, I don't really want you listening to that. They said, why not? It's just news. I said, it's not really news. I said, the way that they speak and divisive and divisive and derogatory. I said, that's just not like the way. So anyways, it was a really fascinating conversation. So then, of course, my kids wanted examples, so I put it on. And of course, I regretted doing that because, anyways. So, but yes, it's important for us to always remember the power of speech. And as we've spoken about in the past, speech has that dual capacity, right? I've quoted from Gary Chapman many times, and to me, it's one of the greatest imageries, where Gary Chapman in his five love languages says that speech can either be, or words can either be like bullets, or they could be like seeds, right? They could be like bullets. It could destroy people. It could destroy lives. It could tear people down. Or words can be like seeds. If planted properly, it can grow and flourish and create love and camaraderie and community. So words have an enormous power. And that, according to the Radak, According to Malbim, that's what the message of this chapter of Tehillim is about. It's a reminder to us about the power of speech. But if you look at Rashi, in the Midrashim, again, Rashi is building off Midrashim, Rashi says something incredible, totally out of left field for our study of Tehillim. In fact, we're probably up to our, I'm guessing, our 90th class on Tehillim at this point. This is the first time that we've encountered anything like this. Rashi says the following, I'll read it slowly, I'll translate. Mizmor Zeh, in future, if anyone has a Tehillim and they want to bring it, obviously you're welcome to. Mizmor Zeh Darshu Balei Agados. Rashi says, this chapter was understood by Chazal al Daniel. It's talking about Daniel. Now, what's the problem about this, Dr. Schwartz?
Daniel moving several hundred.
Correct. Daniel lives several hundred years later after the story, after David writes Tehillim. So, okay, but Chazal say that this parak Tehillim is al Daniel. Shehushlach l'gov harayot. Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. Those who used to come to our class, remember, we studied Daniel for, I think, 2 years even, right? So Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. Let's just do a little bit of a background. Babylonian exile, right? The first base of Mikdash is destroyed. The Jews are sent into Babel. They're sent there for 70 years. When they come back, that's the story of Ahasuerus, that's Purim, that's Ezra and Nehemiah at the end of those 70 years, and the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt then. But in that 70-year period, that's the story of Daniel. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, those stories where they're thrown into the fiery furnace, where they're thrown into the lion's den. It's fascinating. You should read at least the first parak of Daniel. After that, it goes into Aramaic, which makes it a little bit harder to understand, certainly reading the Aramaic. You can read the English. But Daniel is that first group that's brought over from Babel. And where are they put? Anyone remember from our studies of Daniel? Those four, Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, are put in Nebuchadnezzar's palace, and they are there to serve Nebuchadnezzar. Why are they put in Nebuchadnezzar's palace? Why does Nebuchadnezzar want a bunch of teenagers, Jewish teenagers, working for him? So if you remember from our study back then, that was part of his effort to assimilate the Jews. Part of his effort to assimilate the Jews was him saying, if I can get the young people to assimilate, then I can ruin an entire generation of Jews. And so he takes the younger leaders of the Jewish people, he brings them into his palace. If you remember, he gives them all Babylonian names. He forces them to eat non-kosher. That's when Daniel makes his stand and says, I'm only going to eat rice and beans. I don't want to eat non-kosher. It was a whole thing over there, right? But part of what Nebuchadnezzar was trying to do was saying to himself, if I can assimilate, right? Think about Russia. Think about all these countries that said, if we can cut off education, if we can prevent young Jews from learning Torah, then we'll wipe out an entire generation of knowledge. And unfortunately, you saw that happen in your generation. I was born the tail end of it, right? But we saw that in Russia, exactly that happened. So Nebuchadnezzar tries to do that. So Daniel is there right at the beginning of the Babylonian exile. So says Rashi, we're talking about that. That when Daniel is thrown into the lion's den, V'yafa nofel kol, right? And then instead of Daniel getting killed, what ends up happening? The people who throw him in end up getting thrown in, and they end up dying, and Daniel gets saved. Kola shona mizmar al hagada. Every pasuk in this chapter, says Rashi, is a reference to that story of Daniel in the lion's den. Aye, what about Dr. Schwartz's question, which is Daniel doesn't happen for hundreds of years later. How did David HaMelech know about this? Says Rashi, Tzafa David beruach HaKodesh kol ha-ma'orolo. David saw with Ruach HaKodesh, with divine, prophecy, with prophetic vision. David saw exactly what was going to happen. V'hitpalel alav. And David davens for Daniel. And, right, Daniel Mizaro Haya. Fascinating. He says, because Daniel was a descendant of David HaMelech. How do we know that? Because when Chizkiyahu and Yeshayahu, so when Yeshayahu is saying negatively about something Chizkiyahu did, he says, "Umibanecha shirtoli yikachu, that your children they are going to take." Says Rashi, "Vahayu sarisim behecha melech Babel elo Daniel Hanani Mishael Azari." So Daniel was the descendant of David. David saw beruach hakodesh that Daniel is going to have hardship, that he's going to be sent into exile, and he davens for what's going to happen in the future to his descendants. Why is that story in Sefer Tehillim then? It's such a strange, right? We don't have anything else. We don't talk about the story of Ezra and Nehemiah. We don't talk, I think of Achashverosh, Purim, right? David should write about Purim. Daniel, such a strange thing. So what I was thinking, I welcome your suggestions. What I was thinking is it's actually a beautiful message for generations. Because what David HaMelech is really saying is that the story of Daniel is a story for every single one of us, right? Whether we are physically in exile or emotionally we feel exiled, there's a moment in every one of our lives where we feel a Daniel existence. Cast away, foreign land, hopeless situation, right? Being encircled by lions. Obviously, you know, please God, I feel that way every time I see a dog, but hopefully we never have lions around us. But, you know, if you think about it from an image perspective, right, there are times where you feel like the lions are all around you, that they're surrounding you, right? Maybe it could be sometimes something at work where your bosses are treating you in an inappropriate way. Maybe it's sometimes it's politics and community, right? We all feel sometimes like we're in that proverbial lion's den. And what David is saying is that when you feel like you're in that proverbial lion's den and that you're about to be attacked both overtly and covertly, when you feel that threat descending upon you, so David says you should always remember this. How he ends the chapter of Tehillim, which is that if your enemies are going to catch you off guard, remember that arrow which is going to appear out of nowhere. It's going to catch you off guard when you're least expecting. David says, you know what else is going to happen when you least expect? And that is Hashem's salvation. That's the symmetry of the Perek of Tehillim. It starts off within Pasuk Dalet, Asher Shananu Kecherev Lashonam, that the enemies are sharpening their words like swords, like arrows, Darcho Chitzam, that it's like arrows. And then if you look toward the end, what is Hashem going to do the exact same way? V'yoreim Elohim Chetz Pitom. Hashem is going to come out of the blue the exact same way. And so just as the enemies tried to catch us off guard, Hashem is going to come and Hashem is going to catch them off guard. Hashem's salvation sometimes is going to come out of the blue. And that's a theme that we've seen many times. That reminder, the emuna, the reinforcement of that notion that no matter how precarious a situation you and I are in, we always have to believe in that word, pitom, that notion of suddenness. Right, we say it on kinos. The first kino we say has that word pitom in it. And the Rav says, why is it pitom? The Rav says, because even though we should have realized it's happening, when tragedy really, it feels sudden. Right, so the Holocaust, now we can look at it, and there was build up, and we saw Hitler coming to power, and post-World War I, the economy. But for the Jews, it still felt sudden, because they didn't believe it was going to happen. Right, so oftentimes we might see the writing on the wall, but we're in a little bit of denial, but it feels very sudden. Says David HaMelech, you know what else is going to be very sudden? You might be at the banks of the Yam Suf. You might be in a lion's den, right? There are situations in life where we feel caught between the rock and the hard place, that there's no reasonable, rational path out. And yet it's that word in Pasuk Chet of Pit'om, that Hashem's salvation is going to come out of nowhere. That all of a sudden that arrow, the arrow that's on our team is going to come out of nowhere. It's going to save us. V'hayu makosam. And it's going to hurt them. It's going to wound them. Right? Which again is a reference to the sword. So you have the sword and the arrow of what the enemies are trying to do. And then the Mefarshim point out, you have that symmetry where you have the sword and the arrow of what Hashem is going to do towards our enemies. And if that's the case, then I think this parak of Tehillim speaks to all of us, because I think there all of us have moments in our lives where we feel like David HaMelech feels in this chapter of Tehillim. Whether he's speaking about his own personal examples, about Doeg HaDomi, people speaking negatively about him, and a reminder about the power of our words, that words can be bullets or words can be seeds. Or if you follow the Malbim, the Medrash, Mitzudas David, that line of interpretation, that this is David speaking about Beruach HaKodesh, about Daniel in the lion's den, I think that's an equally beautiful interpretation. Because he's not just writing it about Daniel. He's writing it about a lesson to the Jewish people in perpetuity. That whenever you find yourself on a micro, macro level in those situations, whenever you find yourself in that proverbial lion's den, always remember, in that Yeshua Hashem Kerev Ayin, that Hashem's salvation can literally come out of nowhere. And when we see that, and when we recognize it, now you appreciate the last two psukim of the parak. Vayiru kol adam. Everyone's going to see this. Vayagidu poal Elohim. And they're going to speak about it. They're going to declare it. The hand of God. Umaseu iskilu. Laskil means they're going to recognize it. Laskil means it was there the whole time. We just didn't recognize it. So it's that feeling of a post-six-day war. It's a feeling when Hashem's hand is manifest in the world and everyone says, wow, the God of the Jewish people must really be looking out for them. And then, when we see that and we experience that, now you understand the last pasuk. Yismach tzadik b'Hashem v'chasabo. The righteous person always rejoices in God v'chasabo. Why? Because we always put our trust in Him. V'yishallelu kol yishrelev. And all good people are going to sing the praises towards Hashem. So it's a lesson in emuna, according to Rashi, that even in the darkest, most difficult of situations, never to, God forbid, lose sight of the fact that ultimately Hashem provides the salvation for the Jewish people, the same way He provides it for David, and the same way He provides it for Daniel. David wants us to know He'll provide it for us as well. That is chapter 64 of Tehillim. Hopefully what we've done is taken a chapter that's not so familiar, doesn't appear in davening. None of the psukim here are made into songs, right? Oftentimes a little bit easier to reference that. And yet, I hope now that I've shared a little bit of how it's understood against the different classic Meforshim, is a reminder of how relevant the Book of Tehillim is for us, how relatable it is to circumstances that we find ourselves in, and ultimately what it's meant to do is to reinforce our emunah in Hashem and our belief in Hashem under any difficult circumstances. And with that, I want to thank